Good morning, viewers, and welcome back to the Million Dollar Multifamily Mindset Podcast. I'm your host, Miana Epps, also known as the Property Princess. And today I have the pleasure of interviewing somebody who I really look up to and admire. We're kind of in the same, we're headed in the same direction, but he's a few steps ahead of me, and I'm really inspired by his journey. Jerome Myers, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Awesome. It's my pleasure. So, Jerome, why don't you tell our viewers a little bit about where you're from, what you do, what's your background?
Wow. Okay. So, yes, three questions at the same time. Let me see if I can
tell us where you're from.
I'm from Fayetteville, North Carolina. I'm a Army brat, believe it or not. I lived in the same house for 18 years. My father was in the military, and he wanted me to have roots. And so he took 1 year deployments in the middle of all the different wars. And so we never actually had to move. We just were separated from them at 6 months, twice. But it was really cool because he had some childhood issues where he grew up in the country and then his mom moved him up to New York when he was, I think he was 13. And then, but she was never at home. So she worked at night while he was in school. She was sleeping, and then when he got home, he was never there. And so my dad actually graduated at 16 and joined the Marines.
Wow. Awesome.
And while he was in the Marines, he went out in to Alaska, where he met my mom, which is so crazy because they were in North Carolina, South Carolina, but they had to go all the way across the world to meet each other, and then they came back, and they've been together forever. But it's so cool to see how we as parents make decisions to try to make our children's lives better.
And that'll be absolutely
a story.
That's a wonderful story.
So you were asking about my background. So I went to North Carolina Agricultural and Technical State University, got an engineering degree after I left Fayetteville. Knew then that I didn't really want a job per se, but couldn't figure out how to do it. So I had two options out of school, either go start my PhD or start work. And so I began working as a structural engineer, did that for a little bit, got on the leadership track, got fast tracked. And then 2009 came, and the folks that were kind of helping me move, my career along, they got terminated. And so I was stuck in this job where I was doing swing shifts, had to work a few weekends a month, and I just hated it. And ended up in this really dark place and started questioning everything that I've been taught. And had some realizations. And so started looking for other opportunities. And so I left the big company that I was working for, moved into some consulting firms, worked at two different consulting firms. And then my last role in corporate America was leading a division for a construction company.
Okay.
And we were taking overhead power lines and putting them underground. And one of the things that I've always been able to do was work on projects that nobody else had actually done. So setting up processes and systems and all those different things. And this was my opportunity to really figure out what entrepreneurship was without taking a pay cut. I was fortunate enough to start making six figures when I was at 26. And so, of course, my lifestyle grew a little bit, but I wasn't living up against, you know, everything or spending everything that I was making. But, you know, taking that drastic pay cut is something that I think most people are scared of when they want to go and start their own thing. So I showed up as employee number two in the division. We had $0 in revenue. This was January 13th. By August 13th, we had about 175 people working for us. And by the end of the year, we billed our customer $20 million.
We
were 30% profitable that year, go around another year, and we were able to do the same thing, but with a smaller workforce this time. So in December of that first year, the client came back and said, we need you to reduce your workforce by about 50%. I was like, how are we going to do that? And in the end, we just laid people off. It was my first time picking who stayed and who went. And I was just like, this sucks. I never want to do this again.
Horrible.
Well, fast forward, after we put all the pieces back together, recreated the team, you know, we're leaner, we're meaner, we're doing a better job with the stuff that was put in front of us. They come back and say, hey, we need to make some more reductions in force. And I'm looking around, I'm like, this doesn't make sense. I'm not doing this again. And so I exited corporate America at that point.
Wow, just like that.
Real estate full time, yeah. I mean, I got a $30,000 bonus that year, and I've been saving pretty aggressively, and I had a pretty robust emergency savings account, and I wasn't spending the majority of the money that I was making just because, you know, my income had increased pretty dramatically. So for me, it wasn't about buying more things. And the one thing that I gave up in, you know, growing the income was coaching high school football. And so I played football all the way through college, and it was, that was really my opportunity to give back and sow into other people. When we got to the place where it's like, all right, what are you going to do? You're going to make more money. You're going to get a better job, or you're going to continue to coach football. And the better job, they were mutually exclusive because I had to travel on my consulting gigs.
Right.
And so I took the role, and I regretted that for a long time. And so now I get back to that now because I started coaching folks and helping them make their transitions, whether it's out of corporate America into real estate, or whether they just want to figure out how to grow their income in corporate America or their responsibility or get some more fulfilling work. And so, you know, the crux of our investment strategy is to buy 1,000 doors and partner with 100 people so that they can be free from work they're not passionate about.
That's awesome.
You know, they've solved their income problem by investing in real estate.
So that sounds like a pretty huge transition you had to undergo, Jerome. What was like one of the first things you did? Okay, so you left corporate America. What did you do to start, you know, making moves towards entrepreneurship, like putting your business plan in place? What was the first step for you?
So it wasn't well thought out, right? So I made a decision I wasn't going to do it, or I was going to walk out. And I'd actually probably made that decision 6 months or so before I actually found out that we're going to start laying off again. I was just tired of the bureaucracy and some of the other stuff. And so I'd begun saving, right? And so I had over a year's worth of expenses saved up. And I figured, all right, I got a year to figure out how to make this thing work. Okay. The thing that I didn't know going in, though, was I wasn't going to be able to do a multifamily deal because I didn't know anybody that had done multifamily. Right. If you want to buy a commercial property and you want to put debt, bank debt on it, you are not going to be able to get that loan if you don't have somebody that's a partner that's already done a deal of similar type.
Very true.
When Daron and I were sitting on a stoop in college our sophomore year, and we started adding up how much money the owner was making. Right. Because he was paying $395. I was paying $395. We each had two roommates. And so the units were making whatever. And when you added it all up and multiplied it out, it was $700,000 worth of gross rents for whoever owned the property. But we didn't know who that person was because we never talked to him. He had third party property management going and so on and so forth. So it was just like, well, how do you do that? And so now I walked into the bank, you know, I thought I had pretty significant reserves in the bank. I had a great credit score. I had this experience. I had an MBA. I had a PE license. I had my contractor's license. I walk in the bank and I'm like, I'm your dream, right? I got all the certs. I got all the qualifications. You guys should want to be excited to lend to me. And they're like, yeah, but you haven't bought an apartment before. And I was like, well, we use third-party property manager, blah, 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 blah. And they're like, nah. And I did that.
How many units was that first one?
The first deal that I went to, there were a couple of first deals, right? I think this first one was probably 50 that I was looking at in a economy that was going down. I was doing everything wrong. Like, I didn't know what I was doing. I wasn't properly educated. And so, I mean, that part was actually helpful. But what I learned in hindsight is the bank was absolutely right. So we did a deal. The first deal was 23 units, and I'll get to how I got into the first deal, but the first deal was 23 units, okay. And we made some budgeting mistakes when we went into the first deal. And so it's cool if you're doing it on a fix and flip, right, and you underestimate your budget by $2,500. But if you've got 23 units and you underestimate your budget on each one of those units by $2,500, you got a real problem.
That's a big problem, right.
You know what I mean? Like, that's a real problem for people who aren't already independently wealthy. And so had I been able to get financing on that property by myself, I would have been bankrupt. But fortunately, the bank was smarter than me, and they kept me from doing that deal by myself. So I got turned down a number of different times, and I was like, all right, well, I'm just going to fix and flip. I've been lending money to people that were doing fix and flips, and I was like, you can pay me 20% and you don't care. He's like, man, it's just the cost of doing business. I'm making 2,000% on the money. I'm like, what do you mean? And it was like, how can you make that kind of money on what you're doing?
And so you had a short break where you started to become a private money lender in between.
No. So I was lending money while I was working, right?
Oh,
so,
okay.
Yeah. I was just putting that money to work, and it was an opportunity for me to get on the inside of the business and see what was actually going on.
Right.
And so I learned about rehabbing that way. And so I still had loans out. So some money was coming back in from the loans. But when I decided, hey, I'm going to fix and flip myself because I can't buy an apartment deal, and I've got to wait until I actually find somebody to go on a deal with me.
Yeah. Like,
you know, I'd been looking for partners to do business since I got out of college, and I just wasn't successful at finding partners to do any kind of business, let alone put millions of dollars of debt in your hand. Right. So, and when I look back at it, I just feel so silly because I just didn't know so much stuff that I should have known going in. So I was fixing and flipping, and I was sitting on the porch of one of my fix and flip houses, and an investor came up and he was like, hey man, let me check out your finishes. We're getting ready to start a rehab down the street. I just want to see what you guys are doing so that we know what type of finish level we should have. And then he was asking about what I was going to market at and so on and so forth. And he was like, hey, do you know anything about this building in Church Hill? I was like, yeah, I tried to buy that 4 or 5 months ago, but I couldn't get it done. He's like, well, I'm gonna make an offer on it today. I just wanted to know if you knew anything about it that might help me out. And I was like, look, please don't leave me out the deal. Like, I really want to get in a multifamily.
Awesome.
This guy had actually just done like a 10 unit or a 12 unit not too long ago. And so this was his next step into the game. And he was like, okay, well, how much money are you going to bring? I said, well, it depends. Like, let's look at the deal and let me see what makes sense. And so he ignored me, right? And went and put the offer in himself, and it didn't pan out for him. And so he went and talked to one of the guys that I used to lend money to. And he was like, hey, I want to put this deal together. And he's like, oh, man, that's the one Jerome told me about back in January. I'm only doing it if he wants in, too. And so he brought me in. He was going to be the contractor. I was going to be the project manager. The other guy was kind of our experienced partner. And then the broker actually came into the deal as well because he wanted to get the commission on the front and the back end. And then we got to the place where we're going through due diligence, and we're like, what else could make the team stronger and who else could bring some cash? And so we found a property manager that was well-respected in the area. He came into the deal as well. And so, you know, it was the five of us going to take down this huge project in a dilapidated part of.
So let's talk about that, Jerome, because you mentioned the five of you, right? Let's talk about the importance of putting together the right team. So which each of you brought to the table and what you contributed. You have one person who's going to manage the project. You have one person who's putting up the money. You have one person who's the contractor. You have another person. What was the broker's contribution? Were they just like another financial partner?
They were a financial partner, and they were supposed to help with modeling and comps and all those resources. He worked for one of the bigger brokerages in town. So
okay. And then obviously you have your property manager who's going to help you with operations, right? So pretty much you guys had a solid dream team right there, the five of you.
It sounds like it, but it's the worst partnership I've ever done. Right? So, you know, the most important thing outside of any of the experience and the cash and all the other stuff I would tell anybody is make sure your values are aligned. You know, everybody's out for themselves, you're going to set yourself up for failure. If everybody doesn't have the same investment criteria, you're going to have a real issue. And, you know, you don't have to think about problems the same way. Like, you want diversity of thought, but when you actually commit to a path, everybody's got to be on the same page.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
When they get into this space, it's like, I'm going to do my own thing. I'm independent. But, you know, you actually rig success when you have the same values. And you better find that out before you get in a deal because you're getting married. It's nothing worse than, and it's interesting when you see people go to conferences and they're like, yeah, we're going to start a partnership after they talk for an hour. Like, you don't know that. And it's, for me, I consider it getting married. I mean, it's getting married with the prenup in place, right? We're going to end this partnership in 5, 7, 10 years.
It's true.
And here's what you own, here's what I own, and here's what I expect you to do, here's what you expect me to do. Like, everything's laid out.
Right.
But, you know, everybody's got their risk. But for that loan that we did, everybody's fully responsible for the whole note. And so.
It was a non-recourse loan?
No. So every loan that we do, because we want to be able to refinance out and return capital, the original investor principal, we do recourse loans up front, and then we refinance into non-recourse debt. The goal is always to force appreciation. We don't buy anything that's already performing. I buy broken apartment.
Right. Yeah. So talk about how that unraveled. Like, what did you learn? Where did you guys go wrong? Well, I know you had different interests, but how did you guys get out of the project? What ended up happening?
Oh, so we're still in the project. It's just, it just wasn't like super functional. Like we
got it.
We agreed on approach, then we didn't agree on approach. We had a business strategy, we changed the business strategy. And so when you have those fits and starts, it impacts the project adversely because time is money. Anytime that your property isn't performing as it should, you can't make that back up. And so your cash on cash returns start to suffer, in which the internal rate of return on the project suffers. And so, but you know, in the end, we worked through it. We did an amazing renovation, new roofs, new siding, new windows in places, new parking lot landscaping, took a wall out on the first floor, added laundry and bathroom on the first floor, vinyl plank throughout, granite, stainless steel appliances, new lighting, paint. I mean, you name it, we touched every surface there, added central HVAC. And so, you know, it was probably the most difficult project that you can do in the toughest asset class. So we bought in a gentrifying area where property values probably over the course of 5 years went, like the average house was selling for like 200,000, went to 400,000. And so this was kind of the eyesore in the community. And so we picked that up and we turned that project around. And so we took rents from $695 to $1,195 on that project.
Wow, that's so huge.
We got through it and it was a juicy project, but at the end of the day, you know, it was tough to actually go in and create that because you got the internal arm wrestling between the different partners. And so having clarity about, you know, the investment thesis and driving those results is what's core if you're going to actually be successful in a partnership, because it could have unraveled. Like if you got to do a capital call and people aren't in agreement with why you're bringing extra money into the table, it becomes a fight. And so the big takeaway there is make sure you understand your operating agreement. The things that are on paper actually make sense. Make sure you have a asset management contract. Make sure your general contractor has the right incentives in their contract to make sure that they perform. Because ownership may not be enough. You know, they may be distracted on something else that's making more money for them right there because it's more profitable in that way.
Right.
And so just making sure you have alignment of interest is probably the most important thing that I can say for anybody that's getting into a JV.
That's a good piece of advice. What other piece of advice would you give to a person who's looking to get started in real estate investing?
So I can only speak from experience, right? Don't do what I did. Like I did it the most inefficient and ineffective way. I listened to podcasts and I graduated from YouTube University, and that's how I did my first deal. Yeah, I'm not telling people to go pay, you know, $25,000 or $50,000 for a course, because I don't think you have to buy a used Mercedes-Benz in order to get into multifamily and find out if this is going to work for you or how it's going to work for you. Not to say that those courses aren't worth it, because you can lose way more than that if you do it the wrong way.
Yeah, that's true.
But what I will say is find an opportunity to get some education from a thought leader in one concise package.
Yeah.
This whole concept that, you know, I listen to about 40 hours of content a week, right? And it varies from all the top podcasters to people who I might
meet. That's a full-time job right there, Jerome.
Well, this is all I do, right? It's my ambition to be the expert, right?
Yeah.
And so I want to be the best operator in the country. And so I don't want my lack of knowledge to be the reason why I don't do what I'm supposed to do. So I've committed to that. I know everybody doesn't have that capacity. And so if you think about the amount of information that I consumed in order to get into my first deal. And you think about me having to boil all that down, right? I might listen to a 30-minute podcast, but there's really only 5 minutes to take.
Yeah, you're extracting the best pieces, right?
And then trying to apply that to my strategy. I mean, I flew around the country. Like, there was a group in Dallas who had done a rehab similar to what we were doing. And so I heard that guy on a podcast. I jumped on a plane and I went and spent 2 days with them just seeing how they were executing against their business plan. And, you know, everybody's not going to be able to do that. So find somebody that's got a course or is teaching so that you can get the step-by-step process that they're using as your baseline. And then once you have that baseline, go out and do your own self-education. You can't get away from the self-education, but you want to have a foundation, right? And I think a lot of people want to skip over those steps. Like, there is no shortcut in this business.
No shortcuts.
If you shortcut it, you're going to end up with something that you really don't want. And, you know, the question becomes, all right, well, can I say I got a deal? I always smile when somebody says, well, I lost money in my first deal, but I didn't pay anybody to do it. I'm like, dude, you probably lost more money than you would have paid in education, and you could have avoided that, and you could have made your mistake on a bigger issue, right? Not something that's foundational. I was just looking back at one of my models, my early models for a property that we bought, and I modeled our taxes at $1,000. The taxes were $10,000 on the first year. And so it's just like, surprise, surprise, if somebody actually looked at my model that knew what they were doing, they would have said, what are you doing?
Right? Yeah. Like,
you're completely missing the boat on this. And, you know, I was proud of myself because I did it. And now, mind you, we make over $100,000 a year on that property. So that $10,000 wasn't a big deal. But the fact of the matter was, like, those little mistakes could have been really big mistakes, and I could have tripped and fell on my face.
Who are some of the people that you follow or pay attention to closely?
You know, there's one guy that's really come into my world lately that I'm really excited about, Mr. Sharma out of the Philly market. He and his dad just took down a $50 million deal, just the two of them.
Wow.
Syndication, some bank debt. And so he's got, his family's got like 4,000 units, a little over 4,000 units. And so he's coming to my world at just the right time as we begin to scale. But, you know, all of the regulars, I listen to Joe Fairless, I listen to Rod Khalif, I listen to Michael Blank, I listen to Jake and Gino, I listen to John Kasman. You know, I listen to all the folks at Whitney Sewell, I listen to David Johnson, like, I listen to a lot of folks. But you got to remember, I listen to 40 hours of content a week. Yeah. Everybody's not going to be able to listen to everybody
right.
on the podcast. But I think there is a gap in the marketplace, right? I don't think the majority of people's first deal is going to be a syndication. And so there needs to be somebody out there, and it's actually the gap we're trying to fill, who's talking joint ventures, and how do you joint venture successfully, and what you need to know, and what the roles are, and how you actually uncover and turn over the rocks and meet people who are interested in doing the same thing.
You know, I'm in the same space, right? So my partners and I, we're looking for joint venture partnerships, but also trying to accomplish and achieve the syndication deal, right? So it is difficult when you're thinking about, actually, I would say it's probably even more difficult to be in a JV partnership, because at that point you have, you know, five minds trying to make one decision, versus in a syndication, there's some level of control that you have over the decisions that are being made, and there's less potential for conflict or, you know, disagreements, I would say. But so, it's definitely harder to organize.
I think about JVs and syndications a little different from a lot of people, and this may be helpful for the listeners or not. But so JVs sit in both spaces. The general partnership is usually JV. I don't know many people who can, you know, take down their own $10 million deal from a net worth and liquidity standpoint. And so it's usually done by committee. There's probably a lead, which is normal, but, you know, there's still other partners that are in the GP who are getting compensated for either raising capital or operations or asset management or whatever role they're actually filling. And I guess I shouldn't say raising capital, investor relations is probably a better way to
investor relations.
Yeah, so, you know, but, you know, that JV structure exists in both places. It's just a matter of whether or not you have the limited partners adding to the pot for you.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, definitely. So What's next for your business? What's your next goal?
Yeah, so we've rolled out Myers Methods, and we started that in the fall of last year, and that's our education brand. And so we're doing a couple of things. We've created an online course for people who want to get that multifamily education. It's about 50 hours of content when you add in all of the homework, in addition to me lecturing for about 25 hours. People will be able to get access to that. We've got a virtual multifamily meetup that we do. Like you, we have a closed Facebook group that people can become a part of. And then the thing that I'm probably most excited about in the first quarter outside of the course is our Mid-Atlantic Multifamily Investing Conference that's going to happen March 20th through the 22nd in Greensboro, North Carolina.
And I'm bringing come check you guys out.
Come on out. Come on out. Bring everybody from Cali with you. But I'm bringing all my multifamily investing friends in. We'll probably have 15 speakers or so, and we're just going to break the business down. My property managers are going to come in and talk about our portfolio. We'll do some tours of our vacant units if we have any, so people can see befores and afters. And really the goal is to put everybody in the same space at the same time. And you're going to get a speaker lineup you won't see anywhere else. I just spoke at Dan Hafer's Multifamily Investor Nation Summit. And I think out of the 40 or so speakers, there were 4 people of color. And so for me, that is something that raises an eyebrow, but it's consistent across the industry, right?
You don't see
thought leaders that are African-American or Indian or whatever demographic Hispanic that you want to put out there. And I want to show people that there are people out there that do exist that are, of color. And that for me is important, because I think oftentimes we think we can't do something if we don't see somebody that looks like us that does it.
Right.
And so, I got dreads, I got tattoos, I played football for a long time. I want people to see that, hey, it doesn't matter what you look like. Like, it's just a rapper. If you've really got a heart, and that's for us as Bay, like, if you really want to make an impact on the community and you want to make an impact on people and you want to make money, then those are the people that we want in our family. Those are the people that we want in our ecosystem. If you're just interested in making money, go somewhere else. If you just want to give housing away, go somewhere else. But if you want to figure out how to make an impact on the community and run a profitable business, that's the team that we want to lock arms with and do stuff with people all across the country, because, our 4-step process, find it, fund it, fix it, and flip it, works everywhere. It doesn't matter. Like, that process is exactly the same. Now, the realities of each market is a little bit different from a cash flow perspective. But, if you use our process, it's pretty safe to say that you're going to be profitable in your business.
That's awesome. Yeah. I'm definitely interested in watching you grow and continuing to watch your journey. Your story actually resonates very close to home with me, because I'm kind of in the same boat. I work a full-time corporate job, and multifamily investing is my passion. And it's easy to say burn the boat, because some people, it's easy for them to walk away from jobs. But if you have a certain standard or cost of living, it's a big risk to take. And I really admire those that have already transitioned, because it's a huge risk. And to see you making it and, having no regrets. How's life as an entrepreneur so far? What's the, the difference?
It's stressful, right? I mean, if you get paid every month on the 26th or you get paid every 2 weeks, that's not to say that that'll happen, right? You get your cash flow from your real estate. You get, if you're an asset manager, you get your asset management fee. But unless you do like a transaction, like that big lump sum payday doesn't happen. And so there'll be months where I don't make money. There'll be months where I make a ton of money. And so being fiscally responsible and making the appropriate investments in your business is, core. If you're a planner, you probably won't be comfortable in the space unless you've taken the precautions and saved up a year or 2 years worth of income. One thing that I want to point out for anybody that's thinking about making that transition, it's about your expenses. It's not about your income. If you make $150,000 a year, you don't need to make $150,000 in real estate in order to live the same lifestyle, right? Because the taxes are different. The way that you do your income tax returns are going to be different as well. And so as long as you're not spending all the money that you make, you can make a transition. And you think about some of the things that you have in your life that are, you're only working so that you have those things, maybe having your time freedom might be worth more than
that. Scale back a little, right?
You might not need the 2020 Corvette. Like, you could probably get okay with a Toyota Camry, like, at least because you have your time. But, you know, there are some people who have to have those things. And, you know, I'm a big proponent of Gary Vee. Like, if you like having those things and you enjoy doing your 60-hour work weeks, mazel tov. Like, great. Keep going. But if you're miserable and you want to do something else with your time and you want to have a different impact in the world, then make adjustments, be uncomfortable for a short amount of time so that you can live the life of your dreams. And, you know, that's what we do in our coaching business, is help people figure out how to do that stuff.
I agree 1,000%. I say the same things all the time, you know, living above your means, or living with high expenses and complaining about what you have to do to make up for it. It's like, you know, scale back. Just, you know, we can do without a lot of the things that we have. I've had a really significant paradigm shift recently. I don't know what happened. Just overnight, I started to not care about a lot of the things that I used to care about. And life is just so much easier, not having to worry about how do I get these things. You know, it's not, for me, it's about passive income. That's all I care about right now. When I can get to the point where my passive income exceeds my active income, then I can look at buying things again.
That's cool. I can't emphasize that point enough. Like, your time is everything. And so, yeah. You know, I travel a lot. Like, I was in Miami for New Year's. I was just back down south for a week last week. I have the freedom,
right?
The ability to do whatever I want. I'm going up to Philly next week. You know, it's, I have the flexibility to do what I want, and I get to control that piece of my schedule. I get to decide when I go and when I come, and I don't think there is anything that trumps that for me.
Right.
You know, I want a Lamborghini. I'll get a Lamborghini one day, but
one day.
Me having a Lamborghini right now and exchanging my flexibility and freedom isn't worth it.
Well, Jerome, I just want to congratulate you again. You're truly an inspiration to everyone that wants to be an investor. You're an inspiration to men of color, people of color in general. Thank you so much for your time today. Where would people be able to follow your journey? How can they reach you or follow you?
So if you don't mind, I'd like to give a giveaway for your listeners. So if they go MyersMethods.com, MyersMethods.com. We're doing a free giveaway. It's just a four-step guide for people who are thinking about multifamily. And it talks about the difference between JVs and syndications. And if they sign up for that, they also get a 15-minute podcast where they just hear me diving deeper into how we think about those issues. And so if they do that, they'll get introduced into my world deeper. The other way that I encourage people to connect with me is on LinkedIn. I'm the only Jerome Myers, again, MYERS, in Greensboro, North Carolina. And then listen to the Dreamcatchers podcast. We got a podcast where we just want to give social proof of people actually catching their dreams. I think there's a ton of focus on chasing your dreams. You got different artists out there calling themselves dream chasers and so on and so forth. But we really want to focus on people who actually complete it, right? There's a bunch of people who start, but how do you finish? And for us, it's all about execution of the strategy. So
that's awesome. I'm about to find that dream catchers, you said?
Yeah.
All right.
Cool. Little picture of me smiling.
See. You got a nice smile, Jerome. Thank you so much for lighting up our day.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for joining. Thank you for joining, listeners. We'll see you next time. Thanks, Jerome.
Bye.